Welcome to our Brave Feminine Leadership podcast, where I get to dig into delicious conversations with global leaders, and I get to ask them all about themselves, about women in leadership, and we get to soak up their perspective and wisdom on life and leadership. And today I am thrilled to have Jackie Clark with me. Jackie, welcome.
Oh, thanks, Melissa. I'm very excited to be here.
Brilliant to have you. Now, let me share with our listeners a little bit about your bio and then we'll get going into the conversation. So Jackie Clark has got a whole range of different letters after her name. We can come to those later, Jackie. But she's the author of Stop Worrying About Money and is a trusted advisor, board member, executor, and veteran business executive. As a personal wealth and money management expert with over three decades of experience, including 25 years at Deloitte and PwC, helping high net worth families, individuals, and business owners to build, manage, and preserve their wealth. So Jackie's message is really simple. With careful planning and effort, you can manage your money so it doesn't manage you. So brilliant to have you here. We are going to touch on the book today, but before we do any of that, let's get into the story of Jackie. And I'm going to hand over to you, Jackie, and say, who are you? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
Oh, wow. Where do you begin? Well, look, I guess as interesting as the next person, but look, I've had an amazing career, Melissa. I'm a mom of five boys in a blended family. Important to mention that we've been a blended family for over a decade. And have raised five amazing kids who are all around the world doing lots of different things at the moment. And I say that first and foremost because that's a challenge in itself, having been divorced back in my late 30s and bringing a family together like that is quite an incredible journey. Mm-hmm. I'm a cattle farmer. So I have a cattle property with my husband and we've been doing that for a long time in addition to having pretty heavy corporate careers.
Wow. And
I could go on, but lots of interesting things always on the go. I'm still working with families and boards, as you've mentioned. We run an accounting practice as well that helps run the finance function of a lot of very wealthy families. So there's always exciting things happening and change, which I love now. I didn't always.
Where did you grow up, Jackie?
I am Sydney through and through. Yeah, a real city kid, actually. So that's one of the things that's kind of unique around how the sort of a farm life really appealed to me. I think when you have a really serious or heavy career focus, which I always did, actually, sort of grew up in a family of builders and always thought that everyone needed an accountant. So I was going to have a job for life. Mm. I was very career focused. And I think one of the really special things about being in the outdoors is that it really changes your mindset. And in fact, when I would drive down the freeway to head to Braidwood, where our cattle farm is, or even if I was going away camping or something, it's amazing how quickly you shift out of work and generally crisis mode, because my sense is that for a long time in my corporate career, it was just a constant crisis in the sense that you're just on the go 24/7. And I still kind of am. You know, most of my clients don't wait till Monday morning at 9 o'clock to ring me. They'll text me on Saturday morning when something's happening. So I guess I'm used to that. And I've traveled the world and I'm also used to having work go along with me. So I think one of the nice things is if you can get your mind to have a bit of a rest from that. And that's certainly something that I think has kept us all sane, is having the outback.
So I do have to ask though, why cattle farming? Was there a connection there with your partner? Or
there was. My husband's family is six generations down there. Now the last generation sold out. So his parents' generation got out of there and he wasn't allowed to sort of go to the farm as a young adult. He was as a child there all the time. Mm-hmm. And so Michael said to me, do you want to give this a go? And I said, oh, okay. So we sort of dabbled in this really early on together and then sort of built up our agricultural interest, for want of a better word, over time, because I think we just found it was an incredible, it's a diversion actually from the type of work that we were doing in the city.
Yeah, I really love that. And I know in your book, there's all sorts of different things about people planning sabbaticals and doing things, but also about the importance of mindset and that sort of stuff. And I have a bit of an equivalent where we're lucky to have a place just down the coast. And as I drive down there, there's one vantage point where you can see the lighthouse. And the minute I see that lighthouse, the kids kind of you know, laugh at me because I call out my lighthouse, but it's like, you know, it is.
Yeah, it is like a switch. And look, we worked at the farm a lot during COVID, over different periods, and it's a workspace as much as it is a business and a retreat, if you like. But it's just very different. It's a completely different pace of life. You don't get things done the way you might like to get them done in the city. But you know, it's an important complement, I think, to having a really hectic career.
So let's head to the hectic career, because you did have a very, very big, busy, successful career. Tell us a little bit about that. And I guess I'm particularly interested for our audience in, you know, the transition and decisions to transition away from that.
Yeah, well, should we begin with the end?
Sounds like a good spot.
I did make the decision to retire from the Deloitte partnership 3 years ago. And that came up. That came about 6 months after a pretty horrible experience in the firm that I loved. Mm-hmm. And when I say loved, like, I gave everything to Deloitte. I thought I was going to be there till I was 62, which back then was the retirement age. It's highly publicized as not being allowed to be talked about anymore.
Yes.
But I just thought that was what I was going to do, and then I would continue my board career after that. But it just didn't work out that way for me. I was on a great trajectory there. I was in the executive leadership team. I had just been promoted to the role that I'd always been looking to do. I mean, roles change over time, but you sort of know. And it was sort of like, I guess you call it the second highest one in the business, but the one that made sense to me, it was around markets and clients. It was right up my alley. I was given that promotion. I still remember getting in the car, ringing my mum that day and saying, "Oh, mum, I've actually got that." Not that your family ever really knows what you do, but I said, "I've actually got that job that I really wanted." And then it wasn't a week later when I got called up to the reception floor, and the boss that was there with one of the heads of what you call partner services to say to me that he was unable to give me that promotion. And I was there presenting my plan for the job. So I had gone with the PowerPoints, I had the computer set up. I was in a boardroom, and I'm actually even telling you this now, I'm definitely having like a reaction to, I can't even describe to you, like, my heart rate was going. I couldn't understand why. And when I asked, he said, I had some feedback from some of our team, which was actually my peers, my colleagues.
Right.
And it was like, clearly it was just a misstep here that I'd have been horribly backstabbed by the people that I had worked with for a really long time. And I'm talking 20 years, not sort of 3 years.
Yeah.
These are peers of mine that I'd grown up in the business with. And actually, I never got to the bottom of it. And that was the hardest thing, I think, to swallow going through that process, was just saying, so they had some feedback about my personal style. And I went straight to the CEO at the time, who was ousted anyway. So this was all happening under his leadership. And he said, "Oh, have you asked what the feedback is?" And I said, "Yes," but it took ages to get it. So it was almost like a knee-jerk reaction, and then they couldn't back it up. And I had said, "Oh, look, I'd like to have a coach, somebody to help me." And I did speak to the internal coaching team and found someone external that was really known, I think, for helping people not in these situations, but a senior executive coach, kind of was in and out of these organizations all the time. And she said to me, "My biggest worry for you is that you won't find out who's kind of directed this feedback, if you like, that's had enough of an effect to make them change this decision." And she just helped me navigate the grief cycle, for want of a better word, because it was like, I love this business so much, but almost it didn't love me back.
Yeah.
And so I went through a process, and lo and behold, in 3 years leading up to that, I had said to my boss then that I wanted to plan a sabbatical and I was going to have 3 months off, which was literally a week from this decision.
Situation. Yeah.
And I had over time cut that back to 6 weeks. And I do write about that in the book, because I think that was a mistake. But of course, I was always so focused on my job and the output of my job that I didn't want to have the time out.
Squeezing your sabbatical in.
Absolutely. And we just launched at the time, I was running Australia's Best Managed Companies program, which is a program we bought from Canada, from Deloitte Canada to Australia to launch. It was really exciting. I'd navigated to have Telstra and Google and Qantas as sponsors. Like, it was a really big deal. And anyway, I went away on that trip to cut a long story short, and looked at my navel too many times, complete indecision, because I wasn't being terminated or anything. I was just being told not that job. But it was too much. It was too much to be, I guess, sitting in an organization, a very large organization, but feeling like I didn't have their support, even though they were very good to sort of wrap around me afterwards and say, well, that's, you know, we're just moving on from there. But I just didn't, it wasn't like that. Anyway, at the end of the day, I came back and I did go and see a lawyer, who I work with a lot of lawyers through the type of clients I have. And he said to me, what are you waiting for? And I said, oh, I don't know. I actually burst into tears and said, I love it. And he said, you've got a great network. You've got great clients. You don't need to be in Deloitte anymore. And I had obviously some great mentors that had left Deloitte earlier than I had, who I was talking to, and they were all saying similar things. And I thought, you know what? So I just literally wrote to the CEO and said, I'll resign effective immediately. And then there's a process that you go through, which is, but yeah, I must admit it was faceless and nameless feedback. And it was really difficult to swallow.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do that to someone.
No. And it's that faceless aspect of it, when you have no control or no opportunity to respond, is kind of, you know, soul destroying for people, really.
Yeah.
And to have not done the work beforehand to check that, you know, if that was going to be something that was legitimately going to get in the way of the process, like, yeah, that's
and we do have processes. So that's the thing. Any of these leadership roles are usually dueled out by two candidates. That's often how Deloitte ran processes. This one, there was no actual, in this case, I was the candidate, because it was, I was doing the job under the boss who was holding two at the time. If that makes sense.
When you and I first met, we just had an interesting kind of aside on that, about, because you could have stayed. You had a wonderful career, you had all this incredible stuff going on, you could have stayed there.
Absolutely.
What was, I mean, thank you to this wonderful lawyer for
the, I know, it was like the wake-up call. Look, yes, ask the question.
I guess the question sitting in there was, why didn't you know? Like, what were you going through? Because I know so many people go through this very kind of agonizing decision, just like you, where they've worked somewhere for, you know, a long time in their career, long enough to be a little bit uncertain about what lays on the other side of it. So I want to hear about that.
Yeah, it's so nicely tied to the title of your podcast, actually, because it was really about being brave. I just had to back myself. And I know you and I have spoken, Guillaume Swiggers, who was the former CEO and mentor of mine at Deloitte, not in this period of time, but before that, said to, you know, he equally gave me that shot in the arm, if you like, of confidence around being bigger than what we used to call the green dot, which everyone at Deloitte will recognize from a brand. You know, you think that it's so significant that in the market you may not be worth anything necessarily without it. And I think just having encouraging conversations, but I think one of the important things also was really stretching outside Deloitte and going to my broader network in industry, and alumni was, again, incredibly powerful. So I think talking to them, but perhaps the other thing which is important to raise is financial security was something that has been a driver for me, and largely because I think my parents used to joke I'd have the first dollar that I'd earned until I got divorced and then I had nothing. And so for me, and at that time I was raising three kids, you know, when I was younger and before Michael and I got together, and we had five children together, but I think what was important for me was looking at the horizon and saying, I've got five children there, I want to finish them all through the school that they're at. And so I was actually looking to work out how financially I could make sure that I could continue to provide an education to my kids with whatever was going to come after that. And I think a lot of people get tied into this financial treadmill, and they won't call it necessarily a financial treadmill, but you kind of know, I was all consumed. I was in the biggest Deloitte bubble ever. I lived and breathed the place. Our kids only ever knew Deloitte.
Yep.
As a name, you know, they'd grown up with it. In fact, they were like, I think, devastated, thinking, oh, what do we do without Deloitte? You know, just having known that, as that's the constant in your family. So it was about getting off the treadmill and recognizing that all that really mattered to me was that I was engaged. So I need to be challenged in my work. So I needed to do something that would test me. But from a financial security perspective, all I really cared about was making sure that I was able to deliver on the education for my kids.
Yes.
And that there was a baseline of remuneration or income that I could generate that would cover costs.
Yeah.
And that was my springboard to get off the treadmill.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so you had that kind of financial security, which was great. And again, I do want to pick up on that because I think maybe mm-hmm. it's a point to ask you about it, because it's one of the things that's a really simple point in your book about kind of getting your house in order. Mm-hmm. And I think it's what you call open the front door. I actually yeah. found that quite like simple but powerful, Jackie. Yeah.
I think it can be quite
fun for you.
It did, but I had been going through that process for a long time, because I think one of the things that is a real reset opportunity, like job changes, marriage breakdowns, whatever it is, they're big, they're critical resets in your life. And I think having the time to reflect on your outgoings, which is what I call open the front door costs, is really powerful. And anyone can do it. You don't have to be a numbers person, but essentially getting a bit of paper out, looking at your last month's banking online, looking at your credit cards and working out what is actually going out the door to run this show, for want of a better word. Because I think what you don't want to get in the way of making the right career choice is a mortgage on yeah. a big fancy house somewhere. And so for me, I was going through all those decisions, what's my preparedness to make the changes. And all, I guess what I'm saying is, having been through a divorce, when you have to sell your family home, you have to rent for a while, all those things is a brilliant reset to say, what are the baseline costs or the open the front door costs that fit within this salary or income, if you like?
Mm.
And then over time, naturally, we have this thing called expense creep, where you may earn greater income, you spend more.
Yeah.
The challenge is when you're spending so much and you upsize and upsize homes and get bigger and bigger mortgages because you can, it's very difficult to get out or off. And I see senior executives all the time, partners in professional firms, earning half the income that they were in particular jobs. The challenge is, can they do that and still have that home that they're in? So it's an opportunity for a big reset. And I think a decision to say what really matters. And I think it's that kind of want, need. Because we all, fortunately or unfortunately, get the sort of have more, want more phenomenon is a genuine challenge for us all.
Mm.
And if you can go back to saying what really matters, and it's not often, it's not every day that people are checking in with that, I don't think. If you can do that, then you've got a better chance to change your open the front door costs, or worst case, change your front door.
Front door, fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, there's something else you shared with me that was interesting, because you then had to process what you were going to do next.
Mm.
And, you know, there were options potentially about your husband's business was one option, I think. but you, like, some of the things you shared with me just showed some really great self-awareness. So tell us about that, and how did you kind of navigate through this next phase about...
Yeah. That was really tricky, actually. So I think I certainly helped Michael establish the new business. And I, in the back of my mind, I thought that was, so when I was contemplating my options for leaving Deloitte, and by the way, with notifying your intention to leave a partnership, you have to stay for 6 months.
Right.
But the catch with the 6 months and being paid for that period is that your restraint period doesn't start until that ends.
Oh.
And I knew that I needed to get out there. And so I negotiated with the firm to leave after 6 weeks and not be paid. But I was happy to make that decision. I was happy, again, I guess with the work I've been, personal work I've been doing, I was going to back myself to,
yes.
I'd rather start the clock. I had a really significant restraint, which was 24 months. It was a serious 18 months not talk to clients or anybody. It was like near impossible. So the sooner that started, the better. Anyway, I had thought that one of my options would be joining Maxima, which is our firm, or I was contemplating board roles anyway. And there were a couple of families that had asked me to join their family board, which Deloitte was allowing me to do as opposed to being a consultant to them. So anyway, this kind of funny thing, but we were working through this, and I must admit, I was finding it difficult to navigate. There was another former Deloitte partner in the business as well, and finding it difficult to navigate where my home would be. And probably naturally, as a big work winner, so somebody who would go to market, and I just had a natural thing for being a bit of a rainmaker. Being able to bring revenue into a business. I love doing the work as well, but I think over a long period of time, you less do and you do more of this growing and bringing home the bacon kind of thing. So Michael and I ended up engaging a coach for both of us to navigate through it. And it just became really clear through that process that we had been on this incredible growth trajectory from a career, but as a business as well. I mean, under Guillaume's leadership, Deloitte grew from 250 million in turnover to 2.5 billion. So we were there through all of that. So you can imagine that's happened to your income, the business you're running, the number of people in it, everything.
Yes.
So it's always kind of natural to keep doing that. But my husband, I think he'd been absolutely burnt out by it. He was the COO. And so he had not wanted to run Maxima that way. But I don't know how to do things
anything else
that kind of scale. And so the toughest thing was actually realizing that someone like my personality in there, being bigger than the characters that are in the business, could just completely kill it, destroy it.
Yeah.
Just being bringing almost a set of values that were not aligned with where that business wanted to go.
Yeah.
And so it was really hard because for a long time I felt like they were sort of ignoring me or putting me on the back foot, but I realized what was going on was there's just this, which Michael and I agree, there was just this huge risk that I would blow it up.
Yeah.
Simply by putting far too much pressure on the systems that were in the business that were navigating things in a very different path and a very different timeline to the one that I'm used to driving. And I'm a really hard driver. So, you know, I don't have greater expectations of anyone else more than myself.
Yes.
But that's still high compared to where the business needed to go. You know, I guess they say that about leadership. You tell people where they need to go, not where they want to go necessarily. So it was a big it was a big wake-up call too, but it wasn't so much, it's not that I didn't read the tea leaves on it, it was that it was closing that down as an option, and my brand, my personal brand, is very, very tied to the business anyway.
Yes.
So it's been a little bit tricky navigating that, and still being sort of true to my personal brand, but also supporting the business. So, yeah.
Let me take a brief pause from listening to the podcast for a minute just to check in and see if the conversation's inspiring any new thoughts or any new reflections for you. I hear so often from people in our audience, largely successful and senior professional women, how much they are craving some inspiration into their lives. I would just love to share with you, if you're looking for some, then come and sign up for our Sunday Inspiration email series. You can find a link in the show notes at the end of the show. Now let's get back to the podcast. How did you find time? Because, you know, you've described there, you know, a super high energy, results focused, achievement oriented. I love the term rainmaker. I mean, every business needs rainmakers. Yes. You don't exist otherwise. So, you know, brilliant, but busy and big scale and all those sorts of things. How do you go from such a busy pace? Did you find the space to allow yourself to pause? And like, was that part at all about this next stage, or did you keep running?
Oh, great question. So I signed up my first major client the day after I finished.
Yeah.
There's the answer to your question. Now, would I have done it the same again? Maybe, but there's an opportunity now. And I'm certainly definitely in a slightly different phase now where I'm actually able to reflect back on that the last 3 years and say, is that how I want to continue things? The answer is no. Yeah. And so I'm taking steps. Like, I've got a sabbatical plan this year. Now, when you're your own boss and a sabbatical, it doesn't have the same, it's different to an executive.
Yes.
Sabbatical. However, I will still be working and still participating in board meetings when I'm away, just not in Australia. But it still requires a lot of the same mindset and absolutely the same planning, be it financial and non-financial. So taking a leaf out of my own book, what a pun that is, just setting this plan up, which is about reflecting on what's been And it's a little bit of a celebration too that we've put five boys through school and they're all finished. We cap that nicely. Yeah, exactly. And I think people would typically cheer too if you've paid five lots of private school fees for 20 years. It's quite a celebration. So it is an exciting time for us and just really looking forward to do. And, you know, I'm not sure how good we'll be being away. We're actually not particularly great at it either. So it's as much a test of our ability to be away for a couple of months as it is. We want to kind of engage locally in Europe, like in little country towns and things like that, and focus on health and well-being as well. A lot of these things have shifted, no doubt, for me and for others. I was just reading this brilliant post by a former colleague of mine on LinkedIn over the weekend where he was cleaning out his home and he'd found his old Myers-Briggs report card and he'd listed in there what his sort of top three things were, and they were like money and, you know, house and all this stuff. And he said he's done it again and now it's basically health and well-being.
Yes.
And I think that's really similar for me. If you put a wheel in front of me, I could pull out over the years of the various coaches and people that I've worked with. And there's been a really big shift for me on focus. And in fact, the last sort of 12 months, even a really big shift in, I guess, the longevity conversation and health, you know, living healthily has really come front of mind. I don't know if it's my age, if it's the media. There's definitely been a shift in understanding how to avoid some of the chronic illnesses that plague us and how to change, you know, medicine 3.0, as we call it.
Yes, absolutely. I'm obsessed with it at the moment, having just finished.
Same. Actually, it's hard to get off that drug, that one, Outlive. But everything that Dr. Peter Attia talks about in there, and Tim Spector, and you name it, I've read it all. And I'm not concerned about aging per se, but actually looking at trying to live fully and be as active as I can be for a long time as opposed to a short time. And it does require a bit of effort. It's a bit of an inverse relationship, because when I was hardcore in my career at Deloitte and even at PwC, it was all work and there were these little bits of exercise dotted in, and every aeroplane trip that I had to go on was a sacrifice on diet and exercise, usually because I'd eat cheese and wine, you know, on a plane coming home late at night. I'd never exercise because you're up at 4 a.m. anyway. The only exercise would be walking to the gate at the airport. Well, I can't even imagine now the effect that that would have on me now in going into my 50s sort of thing. So it's, and I'm sorry for the people who are sort of continuing on that type of treadmill from a career perspective, because you need to change it now. And you can always make change. Doesn't matter how late you make it. I read a great article in the paper about a gentleman, 95. You might have seen it in the Sydney Morning in the AFR, who is rowing. But he only started that sort of in his late 70s. I can't remember.
I saw that. Yeah, I saw that. He's incredible.
Started in his late 70s rowing. Anyway.
Jackie, how did the book come about? Like, what? I want to ask you a couple of things about the book, and I want to ask you, you know, probably what the three non-negotiables are in your opinion around money.
Yes.
Tell us the story of the book. The book called Stop Worrying About Money.
Yes. Well, I worried about money. So it's come from a place of someone who at different times in their life worried about money, whether as a young child, as an adult, going through a divorce, certainly changing career, certainly. But probably equally, as you sort of reinvent yourself as you go through career change, I thought there's more to this, you know, what am I doing with my life type question. And, you know, I've worked in not-for-profit space. I've done lots of things that have engaged me, but I sort of had this burning feeling I had so much money wisdom to share, and it's limited to how much you can get out or share or help people, and people have to come to you too, say I need a hand. And over throughout my career, notwithstanding having clients that are always paying for that type of advice, I had a lot of people come to me that I helped personally, and that was actually something that I got a great deal of satisfaction from, usually the fellow partner who said, oh, I need a hand with something, and it was usually because someone was either being divorced or somebody had died. Which is the space that I do tend to spend a lot of time in. And then equally with families, just that intergenerational wealth transition. But it was like it was a legacy process, which was saying, how can I share this information so it can be more broadly shared and help other people, just help more people, was the bottom line. So, of course, I went about like any, you know, person with my level of energy would, and network. And I asked all the people I knew who wrote books, how they go about it. And I eventually sort of got through a process to find somebody who was a great book coach, Kelly Irving, who you might know of. And she just helped structure. And it's really interesting. I'm the most disciplined person, focused, and I work really well with a program, but trying to be creative and do all of that at the same time. And so I had Kelly as my book coach, who was somebody who said, you sign up for this, and this is what you need to deliver over this period of time.
Framework.
And so it was a brilliant framework. And I went through a process with her actually to do a book proposal, where I started writing and getting some samples of my writing done on topic, of course. And then I started to talk to publishers if they liked it. And so the title originally was Living Your Best Life. There you go.
Yeah.
And then the publisher said, actually, I think there's more to this. And two publishers I was talking to quite close before I decided which one to go with, both had this, clearly it was written in it, that it was written from a place where I can help you stop worrying about money. And so I was then able to fine tune the book, if you like, to be stop worrying about money and really help people through kind of navigate all the challenges in life. But it really came from a place of creating a legacy. It wasn't a business tool for me like it is for most people. And I do challenge people often, because I go to people and say, I'd love to do more with this, but I'm not currently not creating a program to roll out, which is a very typical business model. I guess I'm challenging that too. But that's okay. I might change my mind in 5 years from now. And I'm sure the book, what's nice about it is it has that enduring
benefit. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, yeah. So that's a little bit about how I went to write it. But, you know, it's been a fun thing to do. Hard work though, as well.
So what are the three non-negotiables? Like I'm thinking of our audience, right?
Yes.
And apologies if I exclude anyone when I say this, but typically with our audience, it's kind of 30 to 55.
Yes.
Primarily female or identifying as female, and professional career women. You know, the demographic, and a lot who feel a bit stuck in their career too. So, and I think sometimes this can be a big barrier, but give us the non-negotiables.
Look, the number one, which I bang on about, is financial accountability. And what I mean by that is, in any relationship or in any business, do not delegate financial responsibility. And I think I work with a lot of female executives who do come to me for help, but I'm often working with male executives who kind of have got this all nailed, for want of a better word, but there's someone in a relationship who's generally missing out on the numbers.
Yes.
So it is a problem for our financial literacy. So just what I'm saying there is, my first one is taking financial responsibility, holding yourself accountable around numbers, because invariably something will trip you up or something will go wrong. And if you haven't focused on the financial responsibility aspects of your business or your career or your mortgage or your costs or how much you're spending, is at some point you're going to have to reset. And if your financial literacy hasn't been developed over time, you'll be on the back foot. And then you've got to work it out.
It's poor, yeah. Financial
literacy. Financial literacy in Australia has actually declined as well. So that's why I call this out. And if there are three, no doubt, but it's a really big one, and it's tied to all these things because the cascading impacts are quite significant. And remembering that at a time when something goes wrong, you could be dealing with anger, grief, hurt, it could be anything, rejection, you name it. To then have to develop or build up your financial literacy, you're coming off a low base. And so I do find that a lot of people, and particularly women for some reason, just don't really know this stuff like they need to. So that's my number one. And then the second one, which is really tied closely to this, is reviewing your open the front door costs regularly. Now, when I say regularly, every quarter, twice a year, definitely. But actually make sure you know what's running out the door.
Even just doing it, you know, as a starting point before you get to the quarterly updates, just do it.
Yeah. And then I don't know if it's a top three, but challenging myself more and more about the needs versus wants. You know, I follow a lot of the guys who are minimalists now, interestingly, and I'm just quite fascinated by how they live or how they make the choices. And I have to challenge myself with a pattern of behavior that goes with having the latest iPhone, the latest notebook, whatever it is. Yes. I think challenging myself to the stuff I've got, and actually having just done a big shift, we just did a big downsize, which is an incredible experience. I had the ladies who run this amazing business called My Curated Life do a full declutter. Unbelievable experience. But boy, oh boy, that is a great test, because you realize they mapped from our home to our apartment how many cupboards there were. And they said, okay, so this is what you're going from and to. That stuff can't all go. And so making those decisions, I've got my little box of my special things that I keep with me. Anyway, I'm sort of going off on a tangent.
I love that though.
Such a process, yeah. I mean, they're brilliant ex-corporate ladies who run that business. And I never forget, my husband, Michael, he was always a bit funny about it, but when they came back and they said, okay, there's something like 30 cupboards in the kitchen and there's 8 where you're going. And Michael laughed and he just said, okay, yeah, I think you need them, or we need them, I should say. But I was the one who was making all the decisions to, you know, cull or not and donate and all the things that we did. It was a huge program. It was a very well-planned program, actually, to live the life we want to live.
Having done that now, how do you feel?
Yeah. Oh, I cannot tell you. Imagine taking a couple of big kilo weights off your shoulders and putting them away forever. That's exactly what it's like. I cannot tell you how amazing it is. And look, we've done something really unusual, which is bought our kids an apartment in the same place and put them there, the ones that are left at home.
Sort that out. Space.
Now, not everybody can run off and do it. And the 18-year-old is a little bit shell-shocked, but I think he's wisened up to the independent living. We'll just keep that between ourselves. But I just got to tell you, actually, things like maintaining family homes, they're a lot of work.
Yeah.
And we have a family apartment. Everyone still comes here for dinner, those types of things. But, it just takes layers. And no doubt adds years, because I can tell you what it's like, everything from the, you know, the garden to the spa to the, you know, dishwasher, running, making things work all the time, staying on top of things, painting, the make sure the gutters work, the rain goes through them the right way, leaves get cleaned up, you know, I could go on. There was one more. The other thing is, in relationships there's this thing called financial infidelity. And in terms of a not negotiable, I think it's one of those things where if you don't have merged finances, that the risks of financial infidelity are really high when you have separate or maintain separate bank accounts. It's not so much of a problem, but success in relationships around money tend to be when it is brought together. But you've got to be careful of spending habits that you don't know about, and things like gambling and drugs and all that can quite, and gambling can be like, people think, oh, someone does a bit of betting on Saturdays. It can get quite out of hand. And I see clients transfer hundreds of thousands of dollars on a Saturday to some horses, and the mate says this, and then there's the gambling now is, again, and as it's an inverse relationship financial literacy in Australia. It's going the other way. It's a really serious problem. So just being careful that you are observing financially in your household. So it goes back to sort of point one, really, around financial accountability, but taking it seriously so that things like financial infidelity don't happen to you.
How do people, because the first point you brought up is a super important one. And I think I saw the stats. I think there was an Allianz survey last year, was the one I saw anyway, in the Sydney Morning Herald, that talked about 34% of women scored poorly on financial literacy. I think it was versus 16% of men. None of us came off that great. I think it was only 20% of the population scored high. But where do people start with that, Jackie? Because I feel like there is, as a CEO, we worked hard to help people become numbers literate about our business and budgeting and all those sorts of things, knowing that could spill across into people's personal lives. But where do people start? Because there is an intimidation about it that I think comes from being told you're not good at maths at school or something. Like, and you don't need to be good at maths to get this stuff, but it's like, where do people start?
Yeah, it's a great question. I was asked this by a really young lady recently. I was at a book event at Newtown in Sydney, and a young girl asked me a question. I said, do you read the paper? And I said to her, perhaps actually picking up the Australian Financial Review, even just the weekend version, if this is not your space at all, actually picking that up and reading that, I think starts to build the literacy piece. When it comes to open the front door costs, anyone can pick up that job. Anyone can get a piece of paper and a pencil on a Saturday and have a look online at their banking. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Unless, of course, you're in a financially abusive relationship and you don't have access to accounts and things, whole different ballgame. And that's, you know, another session altogether.
Yeah.
But you've got to start by owning it. You know, it's like the showing up thing, which is actually get your paper out. I know a lot of people really fear it. And when it works, and particularly in executive careers, when you basically the money's coming in every month. Like I would often not necessarily be able to quote what I earned, but I know what I spent.
Yes.
Yeah, and most people maybe aren't like that. I might be a bit unusual as a chartered accountant. But I think it's important that you first take ownership of what's going out the door. And that's where you start. And then that literacy, I think, builds over time with, because what happens when you start digging into open the front door costs is you look at things like how much it costs to insure your house, how
Yes.
much it costs to provide electricity to your house. And then you start having conversations with these providers about the costs. And then you start negotiating how to bring costs down or change providers. So you start to build your well, intelligence and education around it, but also your literacy. So I just think that's the best way to start. You know, we've all been burnt by dodgy credit card, or actually kids getting access to credit cards and putting charges on there. You just got to be in it. You've got to be there watching what's going on. And
You
you can't certainly make a change without being aware.
talk about planning for you talk about planning for your death as well as a
Yes.
important thing. A lot of people don't have wills, right?
No, as very similarly tied to this fear of it's almost like if it's working, I don't need to change anything. But unfortunately, we all actually the two certainties in life, death and taxes. So the dying thing's interesting. It's a bit like money and how people often don't talk about money. And I'm encouraging people to talk more about it, particularly at home with your family, with your kids, talking about what things cost. So that, you know, I do go through this topic of kids and money is making sure that they understand all these things because you're trying to skill them up and build their financial literacy for making good financial decisions in life. So probably lost my little, because when you ask that question, I think it's so big.
Huge.
Where do you begin?
Yeah, it's true. Well, you just begin, right? You've just got to do it. I mean, we had some good friends of ours. I remember we sat together and we hadn't finalized our will. This is 10 years ago, probably or so now. And we kind of had an agreement with them that, you know, in 12 months' time, when we got back together for this annual sort of event we did, we would all have our will done.
We have
And
to
we had ours done, but they hadn't had theirs done yet. And I think it was the stumbling block as well was the big conversation about what happens with the kids if something happens to us. Yeah, like
And so what happens is people pause. I had a great conversation with someone during the week, just on Thursday night, and she said to me, "I'm following your advice, getting our wills done or updated." And she said, and this is somebody who's got a really basic set of financial circumstances. And she said, "It's really complicated." And I said, "I know." And people think, "Okay, get my will done." But then they ask you a question and it stops you in your tracks.
yes.
Like, what happens with the kids? You don't have the answer. So what happens? You stop doing the document. The
Yeah.
problem is for the kids, if you don't complete that document, it's a far bigger world of pain than dealing with your grief and everything else along the way
Yes.
than if you'd done a will and botched it up.
Yeah.
You know, so all I could say to people is making sure that your house is in order, which again is a big focus of mine, coming back to that sort of financial accountability bucket, if you like, is making sure you do have a current will. People treat them worse than business plans, which is they write the business plan, it goes in the, you do this big hoo-has, you write the business plan, goes in the drawer, you might be lucky to look at it once a year. You need to do that with your will. Every time something changes in your life, either an asset changes or a relationship changes or somebody has a milestone, you need to update your will. We've got to get our wills done.
Sliding doors question for you as I take you back to that kind of moment 3 or so years ago, where, you know, as you said earlier, that dream role was kind of taken away. You know, if you were to compare. And you don't know what it would have been like. That's the whole sliding doors thing, right? But if you were to compare the opportunity that door might have given you versus the door you've gone through now, where are we? Which door are we taking?
I have no doubt. If I'd gone through the door, had the job, stayed in it, I have no doubt that within some period of time that I would have left anyway. My sense was we were just getting to that point.
Yeah. So
So.
you're through the right door is what I'm hearing with that. Well,
Oh, couldn't tell you. And you know, for a moment I kept saying to people, because this was right on the cusp of COVID. So I kept saying to people, is this the COVID impact on our whole lives, or is this Deloitte? I put it all together, put it through the washing machine, and I realized that not being on aeroplanes all the time, being able to work from home in a really nice environment, being able to connect with people in a more timely way, has been an incredible gift to me personally, and it's the thing that I needed more than anything. So yeah, I couldn't be happier. I think I've explored more relationships. I've grown as a person. I've grown as a parent as well. As a friend, I've been able to focus on relationships that I really gave no time to in my executive role. And I'm glad and I thank those who have been around that let me pick them up again, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
Rebuild.
Yeah, very much so. So, Jackie, the final question I love to ask everybody about brave feminine leadership. What does brave feminine leadership mean to you? And do you think it needs to change?
Well, anyone listening who knows me would say, yes, it needs to change. Of course it does. We need to continue to take the bull by the horns in
Yeah.
respect of brave feminine leadership. You've got to get out there and do it.
I love the cattle reference coming in at the end as
Yes, I am a Taurus. It's
Yep.
like all those things. That's why I said anyone hearing me say this will be laughing, but you've got to get the bull by the horns. I see too often people not taking that opportunity and running with it.
Jackie, thank you so much for joining the conversation. Congratulations on writing the book. I know what a process and sort of labor of love will have been involved in that.
Yes.
And enjoy this upcoming sabbatical. It's been wonderful to be
Yes.
as part of the conversation.
Yeah, I'm glad that we could fit this in.
Worked out well.
Yes.
And that was the end of another podcast conversation. So thank you so much for listening to the episode today. I often hear from leaders who felt inspired by the conversations and are ready to put themselves first. And so I wanted to take a brief moment just to share how I've helped hundreds of women, just like you, become crystal clear on the exact steps they should be following right now to lead an intentional and sustainable life without second-guessing themselves so that they can maximize their influence and impact. I've put some details into the show notes, and there's a link there where you can find out some more about our signature Elevate and Influence program. While you're there, take the time to sign up for our Sunday Inspiration email series. Have a brilliant day.